Today is Wednesday, February 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Protests in Myanmar objecting to the military takeover turn violent. Plus, former U.S. President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial gets underway.
The Senate will convene as a court of impeachment.
And the role of radio in global communications. We'll have these stories and more next. Demonstrators gathered in the streets of Myanmar's capital again on Tuesday for a fourth consecutive day. The rallies violated a set of restrictions imposed by the military junta aimed at stopping the massive protests against the overthrow of the elected civilian government. Tuesday's demonstrations in Naypyidaw occurred just hours after the military announced an 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. curfew would be imposed in the cities of Yangon and Mandalay. The regime also banned gatherings of more than four people across the country. But the demonstrations turned violent Tuesday when a female protester was shot in the head with live ammunition in clashes between protesters and police. The woman, wearing a red shirt and a helmet, dropped to the ground unconscious after being shot. Footage obtained by Reuters News showed her earlier with protesters by what appeared to be a bus stop shelter some distance from the row of riot police as a water cannon sprayed and several shots were heard. A doctor at the hospital who witnessed the woman's treatment told Reuters News that the injury was likely to be fatal. State television reported injuries to police during their attempts to disperse protesters, its first acknowledgement of the demonstrations taking place in the country. The incident marks the first bloodshed since the military led by Army Chief Senior General Min Aung Hlaing overthrew Aung San Suu Kyi's newly elected government on February 1st and detained her and other politicians from her National League for Democracy Party. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial began Tuesday afternoon.
The Senate will convene as a court of impeachment.
On the first day, House impeachment manager Joe Neguse said presidents do not have impunity to do whatever they wish to do before leaving office without facing consequences.
And yet that is the rule that President Trump asks you to adopt. I urge you, we urge you, to decline his request, to vindicate the Constitution, to let us try this case.
Trump lawyer David Schoen tried to make the case that the proceedings were inappropriate.
The impeachment article should be treated as a nullity and dismissed based on the total lack of due process in the House. It should be dismissed because of Speaker Pelosi's intentional abandonment or waiver of jurisdiction, if the House ever acquired jurisdiction. And the article should be dismissed.
Now, to get a full recap of the day's events, I spoke with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson.
Right. So today was a little bit of a procedural day because they needed to take a first vote, a first step towards deciding if the impeachment trial in the Senate should even proceed forward. So they basically were hearing arguments about whether or not this process is constitutional or not. And of course, we know that that has been up for debate because some people on the president, the former president's side, are saying that because he is no longer in office, he cannot have an impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. Now, we know that this vote was something of a foregone conclusion because Democrats and a handful of Republicans did vote to advance that process. So we will be moving forward with the opening arguments in the trial in the next 2 days. And we will hear both sides saying whether or not President Trump was guilty of inciting that January 6th riot.
Now, you mentioned the vote that took place in the Senate on Tuesday afternoon. You know, back in January, there was a similar motion put forward on the Senate floor, and 45 senators voted against holding the impeachment trial. Today, only 44 did. Is there anything you can share with our listeners as to why some other Republicans broke rank with the GOP and sided with the Democrats?
Sure. What we're hearing up on Capitol Hill is that the argument from former President Trump's lawyers was just not effective for a handful of those Senate Republicans. They were telling Hill reporters that what the former president's lawyers were saying didn't even really address the events of January 6th. They didn't defend him against those charges that he incited that mob to riot, and that really they felt that it was needed to be impartial jurors in the Senate trial, and so they had to allow the process to move forward.
One last question here. During former President Trump's first impeachment trial, Chief Justice Roberts presided over the proceedings. In this impeachment trial, you have Senator Leahy. Can you, touch on why that is?
Sure. Yeah, that's another issue that's been up for debate in these past few weeks, along with the discussion about whether you can even put a former U.S. president on trial for impeachment in the U.S. Senate. A lot of the president's supporters have argued that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court should be presiding over these proceedings. And then if you don't have him there, then these proceedings are not legal or correct, that the president is not receiving due process. Now, if we look at how impeachment trials are supposed to be played out, remember, presidents just don't get impeachment trials. All people who hold federal office can be tried for impeachment. It doesn't specifically say that anybody other than the current president of the United States should have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding. So really, that argument is not holding a lot of water, and the Democrats were definitely pushing back on that assertion today in their opening arguments.
VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson. Australia has insisted that it expects basic standards of justice after China formally arrested an Australian journalist on suspicion of illegally supplying state secrets overseas. Phil Mercer has the details.
Cheng Lei, a high-profile television presenter for the Chinese government's English language network CGTN, was detained last August. The Australian citizen has been held in custody in Beijing without charge or access to a lawyer for 6 months. Her formal arrest suggests that Chinese investigators are preparing to prosecute her on suspicion of illegally leaking state secrets. Australia has insisted it expects basic standards of justice and for Ms. Cheng to be treated humanely. Former Australian Foreign Minister Alexander Downer said her arrest appeared to be retaliation by China against Australia, rather than simply a case involving credible allegations. Relations between Canberra and Beijing have deteriorated in recent years because of various political disputes. China has denied allegations of cyber espionage and interfering in Australia's domestic affairs. Canberra's call last year for a global inquiry into the origins of COVID-19, which was first detected in the Chinese city of Wuhan, was interpreted in Beijing as stern criticism of its handling of the pandemic. In 2020, an Australian writer, Yung Hen Zhung, was charged with espionage by Chinese authorities after being held in detention for well over a year. Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne says her government is doing what it can to free its citizens held in China.
The most important thing that we can do is to support those citizens, both Dr. Young and Ms. Cheng. We will raise concerns where we have them with China and provide every level of consular support in these very difficult circumstances.
Bilateral diplomatic tensions have led to sweeping economic sanctions. China has imposed various restrictions and tariffs on a range of Australian farming goods, including barley, beef and wine, as well as coal. Australia has relied on China, its biggest trading partner, for its recent prosperity. Lucrative iron ore exports to China, a key ingredient in steelmaking, have so far avoided the trade war, but analysts believe geopolitical hostilities show no immediate sign of easing. Cheng Lei was born in China, but moved with her parents to Brisbane when she was 9 years old. Her family has called on China to show compassion and allow her to return home to Melbourne to see her two young children. The precise details of the allegations against her have not been divulged by Chinese officials. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The Canadian Foreign Ministry says that Hong Kong has denied access to foreign consulates seeking to provide assistance to detained dual nationals. Semi-autonomous Hong Kong had traditionally accepted dual nationals, unlike its Chinese sovereign, but it has the right to deny consular access under treaties signed when the former British colony returned to China in 1997. Five diplomats say, however, that consular access to dual nationals had largely been granted by local authorities since Hong Kong returned to Chinese rule more than two decades ago. The move signals Hong Kong is tightening enforcement of consular treaties. The change comes as tensions escalate between Western governments and Beijing following the introduction of a sweeping national security law in June of last year. Hundreds of thousands of Hong Kongers are expected to move to Britain in the coming years when they become eligible to apply for British citizenship. Many of the thousands of newly arrived are now organizing initiatives to support others planning their move to Britain. Marta Vanderwolf takes it from here.
While China was preparing the implementation of the national security law in Hong Kong in the summer of 2020, Jennifer was planning to relocate her family to Britain. Like many others, she participated in the 2019 pro-democracy and anti-government demonstrations. But the law passed last summer has Jennifer and others worried their civil liberties could be undermined. The national security law would prevent and punish what it calls acts of secession, subversion, or terrorism activities that threaten national security. The law would also allow Chinese national security organizations to set up agencies in Hong Kong. Critics say it effectively curtails protest and freedom of speech. China says it is needed to restore order and stability. Jennifer, who prefers not to use her real name, spent months online preparing to move her family.
When I came, I was quite well prepared because I could have everything for me settled by myself through a lot of hard work in Hong Kong. So I did a lot of online research and approaching different organizations and departments in the UK to arrange my places to live and arrange school for my child and arrange my account and all that. Most of the families, they come here for the children's future.
Despite never having lived in Britain before, she holds a British national overseas passport. Her family is eligible to apply for a new visa that offers a path to British residency and citizenship. The British government estimates nearly 3 million people are eligible, along with about 2.3 million dependents. Applications open January 31. So far, 7,000 people with a BNO passport have arrived from Hong Kong since July 2020. Jennifer now shares her knowledge about the moving process with other Hong Kongers through volunteer organizations. In recent months, several organizations were established in Britain to provide support to people arriving from Hong Kong and to those planning their move. Simon Cheng is the co-founder and chairman of one such support group, Hong Kongers in Britain. The volunteer-run organization hopes to fill information gaps and smooth the process for the 300,000 Hong Kongers believed to resettle in Britain over the next few years. Cheng says that while there are a lot of questions about the practicality of relocating, such as finding employment and schools, there are deeper concerns regarding China's ability to retaliate, even in Britain.
About 1 month ago, we did the policy study to identify their needs and their concern. The security would be the area of the concern. They were a little bit worried that if they come here, whether they've been harassed, the Chinese authority would be very upset about it. We're not sure yet about, in the future, potential retaliation.
There are dozens of YouTube channels, Facebook groups, and other online platforms where relocated Hong Kongers are sharing information about the visa application and the resettling process. Neil Jameson of UK Welcomes Refugees, an umbrella group helping people enter British society, says providing the right support and information to BNO holders will test British institutions.
The problem would be is that landlords, the National Health Service, the police, and then they will suddenly see these papers they haven't seen before, which is BNO passports. But the vast number of people who would be coming legitimately, do need to be welcomed, do need ideally to have a trusted group to go to in the places they choose to settle.
Britain announced the updated British National Overseas Passport Visa Scheme after the ongoing crackdown on pro-democracy activists by Chinese authorities in Hong Kong. The Chinese government announced it would stop recognizing the BNO as a valid travel document from the moment the BNO application scheme opened to Hong Kong residents. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, London.
This is Science in a Minute.
Some say they felt various symptoms, such as pain around the injection site or a low-grade fever, shortly after getting vaccinated for COVID-19. Those hoping to preempt those painful symptoms may be tempted to take pain relievers like acetaminophen and ibuprofen before getting their shot. According to a popular online story, some doctors say taking those pain meds before getting your COVID-19 vaccination could reduce its effectiveness. Dr. Lisa Marigakis from Johns Hopkins Medicine tells me in an email that the science behind this issue is contradictory, with results on both sides of the matter. She advises those who regularly take these meds for other health conditions to continue to do so as directed by a physician or as needed. Otherwise, she says it's probably best not to take the pain meds before your vaccination, but it's fine to take them afterwards if needed to treat mild side effects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The World Health Organization team investigating the coronavirus in Wuhan, China, says it's uncovered new information about its possible origins. Reuters' Emily Wither reports.
Peter Benenberek, who led the team in its nearly month-long visit, said the virus could have taken a very long and convoluted path, also involving movements across borders.
All the work that has been done on the virus and trying to identify its origin continue to point towards a natural reservoir of this virus and similar viruses in bat population.
But he added it's unlikely that the bats were in Wuhan. He said they were also looking for Chinese blood samples that could indicate that the virus was circulating earlier than first thought. The team of investigators did rule out the possibility that the virus leaked from a lab, which has been the subject of conspiracy theories.
The findings suggest that the laboratory incident hypothesis is extremely unlikely and to explain the introduction of the virus into the human population.
The team has also identified market vendors selling frozen animal products, including farmed wild animals. They plan to further investigate cold chain transmission. China has pushed the idea that the virus can be transmitted from frozen food and has repeatedly announced findings of coronavirus traces on imported food packaging. Members of the team have sought to rein in expectations for the mission, with one expert saying it would probably take years to fully understand the origins of COVID-19.
Reuters reporter Emily Wither. There's a growing outcry in Uganda from relatives of missing opposition supporters who were detained by security forces ahead of last month's election. As Halima Athumani reports, the government confirms 44 people have gone missing since November, and that most of them are from the opposition National Unity Party.
On November 23rd, Mary Namuyanja's husband, Lukwago Martin, was picked up by Ugandan military personnel at his fish stall in Bugolobi Market. More than 2 months later, Namuyanja, who could not hold back her tears, says she still cannot find her husband, even after searching police stations and hospitals. She says, "The children ask me about their father every day. I don't know what to tell them." She says, "I have a little one. They are always falling ill. I have no money to take care of them. Please help me." Namuyanja pleads, "Wherever he is, bring him back." She says, "If he committed any crime, let them take him to court so I can know what's going on. But I don't even know where he is." A week after Martin was taken away, relatives say security personnel picked up two mechanics near the market, including Nanyonga Aaron's husband, Nalumosa Vincent. She says he is still missing. She says, We are in so much pain. The government should help us. My husband committed no crime. Nanyonga says he was not among the protesters. They found him working on a motorcycle, she says. On the day of Martin's detention, 10 other men in the market were also rounded up, including Okumu Charles. He says they were forced into a Toyota van and tortured before some were let go. He says some, like Martin, were picked up because of their association with the opposition National Unity Platform Party, NUP. Okumu says, because Lukwago Martin was a member of NUP, and he was always with our councillor who stood on the NUP ticket. He says they were always together. The ones who were arrested in the garage, the mechanic, Vincent, he was the NUP mobilizer in the Bugolobi area, Okumu says. The other young man, Agaba Ronald, who was arrested, was a strong supporter of NUP, and he did not miss any of the NUP meetings, Okumu says. After earlier denying the kidnappings, Uganda's internal minister, General Jeje Odong, on Thursday released the names of 44 people reported missing around the country. Major General Paul Lokech, Deputy Inspector General of Police, says he has instructed the heads of criminal investigations and intelligence to give him the names of the 44.
And I've also instructed that those people arrested should, if they feel they were a threat to security, must be brought before the courts.
As the government investigates, Ugandan media reports say relatives of opposition supporters continue to report their loved ones missing after they were taken away by authorities. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Colombia is to grant temporary legal status to Venezuelan migrants, which will allow them to work in the country. The UN has called this up an extraordinary display of humanity. From Reuters News, Lucy Fielder.
It's the most important humanitarian gesture in the region for decades, according to UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, and, quote, an extraordinary display of humanity.
Es un gesto humanitario emblemático para la región.
Colombia has been the top destination for those fleeing economic and social collapse in neighboring Venezuela. Nearly a million of those migrants don't currently have papers. And the influx has strained Colombia's fragile public health and education systems. Coronavirus has made the migrants' plight worse by closing down what economic opportunities there are. And tens of thousands returned home in desperation last year. Migrant Reni Mendez says he's in dire need of work.
Because of a lack of documents, being here illegally, we are not taken into account when it comes to work and things like that. And one comes here, at least I have come here, for work. And if I'm given an opportunity, it would be a great help. Thanks to God and the President for giving us this opportunity.
President Iván Duque called the change a milestone, not just in Colombia, but across Latin America.
En la historia, la política de migración.
The new status will last 10 years and free those already legalized from regularly having to reapply for papers.
Reuters' Lucy Fielder. Many broadcasters are using a variety of digital radio for high-quality transmissions reaching faraway lands. Michael Sullivan reports on one format that is starting to play an important role in global communications.
More than 2.5 million cars in India are equipped with digital radio mondial receivers, and India's national broadcaster is expanding digital transmissions on medium wave and on shortwave bands that reach across the globe. This broadcast from India was heard in Brazil. DRM can also be sent on long wave or the higher VHF frequencies used by FM broadcasters. This DRM test from Radio Canada International. And I'm getting old. Transmitting high-quality audio and multiple programs simultaneously. Ruxandra Obreja is chairman of the Digital Radio Mondial Consortium.
You have at least three channels instead of one, or three programs instead of one, three stations.
Britain's BBC, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, and other broadcast services are testing or using the format, including China, now the world's largest DRM shortwave broadcaster. The United States has done tests through Radio Marti broadcasts to Cuba. This 2009 test from Voice of America was heard in Austria.
I hope you'll join me for the next edition of the program as we enjoy the music of young Mr. Eldar Jankarov.
It was broadcast on shortwave, with less of the fading that usually plagues shortwave reception. A retired VOA official, Gerhard Straub, says DRM is radio and more.
Because it's digital data, whether that data is audio, files, images.
The religious broadcaster Trans World Radio sends Bible lessons through DRM to India, China, and Japan. George Ross of Trans World Radio.
And so when it comes to communication, especially getting into areas where we don't have the internet connections, this is the way to go.
DRM's wide coverage with low power, long reach via shortwave, and data capabilities have big advantages over other digital standards. There are challenges, however. Transmitter upgrades are expensive, and there's not yet a large market for DRM receivers, which cost more than their analog counterparts. But prices are coming down, and transmitters use less power while having greater reach than analog transmitters. Reaching areas with no broadband connections, Brazil's national broadcaster is testing DRM for isolated Amazon communities. While a private charity is testing a simpler data system that links mobile phones through shortwave transceivers using digital encoding, not DRM, but similar modern use of old technology. Ruxandra Obreja.
People say, oh, radio is yesterday's platform. We are looking to the future. Well, the future is, as usual, very complicated. And it is a mixture of platforms. I don't think television killed the radio. I don't think that the internet killed television.
DRM, she adds, is part of that future. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well and be safe.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by Russian authorities' decision to sentence opposition figure Alexei Navalny to 2 years and 8 months in prison, replacing his suspended sentence with jail time. Like every Russian citizen, Mr. Navalny is entitled to the rights laid out in the Russian Constitution, said U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement. Moreover, Russia has international obligations to respect equality before the law and the rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. During the hearing before his sentencing, Mr. Navalny made the point that while authorities can lock him up, hundreds of thousands of Russians cannot be locked up. More and more people will recognize this. And when they recognize this, and that moment will come, all of this will fall apart because you cannot lock up the whole country. Tens of thousands of Russian citizens in more than 120 cities and towns turned out each of the last several weekends to peacefully protest the arrest of opposition leader Alexei Navalny to demand his release. Secretary Blinken again called for the Russian government to immediately and unconditionally release Mr. Navalny, as well as the hundreds of other Russian citizens wrongfully detained in recent weeks for exercising their rights, including the rights to freedom of expression and of peaceful assembly. The European Court of Human Rights concluded that Mr. Navalny's 2014 conviction, the grounds for the new sentence, was unlawful and arbitrary and politically motivated. The current proceedings against Mr. Navalny, which began with his detention on January 17th, are a continuation of efforts to violate Mr. Navalny's rights and suppress political pluralism, as the European Court of Human Rights previously found. Even as we work with Russia to advance U.S. interests, said Secretary Blinken, we will coordinate closely with our allies and partners to hold Russia accountable for failing to uphold the rights of its citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.